Now, I knew a lot about gunnery. I've been through 3 gunnery schools, and I hunted quail and stuff like that as a kid. And I knew I did it right, but, you know, you just could, I couldn't tell. So I get home. We have our normal debriefing with the intelligence officers, and I told them to, I want to claim a victory, but please hold it. And so I had to go talk to somebody first to collaborate on it. I gave them those words. So now I said, well, let's go to the officers' club, and that's where we all got together afterwards and talked things over. And now I'm on the way over. I said, how the hell am I going to bring this up? You know, I'm going to say, hey, Johnny, you so-and-so, did you shoot that out from under me? Or, you know, how am I going to bring this up and be dignified about it? So I walk in the club, and he's sitting over on the end of the bar. And he comes running over to me, and he says, Andy, he says, that was the best shot I ever saw. You got that sucker out there about 60 degrees angle off. And I says, oh, Johnny, lucky shot, you know. And I rushed to the phone and claimed my first aerial victory. Not my most exciting moment in the world, but it was pretty exciting. Combat is exciting.
Can I interrupt you just very, very briefly? One of the great things about Warbirds in Review, I'm just sitting here looking at your back, is all the young people that are here, and I don't want to assume a lot of knowledge. We use terms, and we feel like everybody knows Bud Anderson, but, you know, first of all, an ace, a combat ace, is someone who has had 5 confirmed victories. And when you talk about Bud Anderson, you're talking about a triple ace plus 16 and a quarter victories. He was the leading ace of the 363rd Fighter Squadron. When you talk about 2 tours with no bullet holes, that's 116 missions, although there was one bullet hole he might tell you about.
Yeah.
30 years of military service, a great test pilot, both for the United States Air Force, and afterwards with McDonnell Aircraft. Bud Anderson did a lot more than Mustangs, and all you young folks should know that. This is an authentic American guy. And finally, after all of that, I would like everyone who's 90 years or older who's a certified flight instructor to raise their hand. So that's a little more you should know about Bud Anderson.
Thank you, John.
I want to talk about one historical thing and then one more combat story. And then maybe we'll have questions and answers. Maybe we'll talk about flight tests or whatever you want to talk about. But one thing that is generally ignored by historians and writers is how we defeated the Luftwaffe. We had to have air superiority to conduct the invasion. And the classic concept in those days was we'll send the bombers over there, blow up the airfields, blow up the factories, blow up all the airplanes, and that'll do it. And we were trying to do that in the daylight with a Norden bomb sight so we could do it accurately and bomb military targets. Well, it didn't work that way. The British told us it wouldn't work, and but we're Americans. We're going to do it our own way. And they said, you'll take too big of a loss in the daylight. And also, the bomber people thought in the very early days that they could do it by themselves. They didn't need fighters. And, you know, we call it the flying fortress, you know, fight its way in, fight its way out. Well, it didn't work that way when they got over there with the Luftwaffe. And we had fighters over there, but they couldn't go where the bombers wanted to go. And the Luftwaffe wasn't stupid. They waited until that escort left, and then they had at them. And tremendous losses. It was terrible. And the Mustang hadn't really arrived yet. It got over there in late 43, and believe it or not, they were all assigned to the 9th Air Force for ground support. Well, when the 8th Air Force realized they had to have escort, then they said, all right, let's try those Mustangs over there that belong to the 354th Group, the Pioneer Group, a great outfit. They didn't have anything to do, so to speak, except wait for the invasion. So they loaned them to the 8th Air Force, and they were so wildly successful in shooting down the Germans and helping the bombers that they said, okay, we got to have all of our fighter groups are going to be Mustangs from then on. Our 357th Fighter Group was the second one and the first one in the 8th Air Force. So then... what happened in early 1944, they had a big change of command. And General Jimmy Doolittle, whom you all know historically, the guy that bombed Japan, you know, right after Pearl Harbor with the B-25s off the carrier, came over there and took over the 8th Air Force. And he was a different kind of a guy. He had a different background, and he had a little bit different theories about it. And he said, you know, we're going to change these escort tactics. From now on, you fighter pilots, you will, when the enemy attacks, you will pursue and destroy. And what he did is he turned the fighter pilots loose so we could go and shoot down the enemy airplanes. And what actually happened was we killed so many of the experienced German pilots that they lost their capability. They still had airplanes. And then once we did that and made the bombing, you know, the losses less for the bombers, they could go deeper and deeper and deeper. And then, of course, the Mustang could go with them. And when we got all those Mustangs, the bombers... they had it terrible in 42 when they started, but near the end of the war, you believe it or not, some of the bomber pilots never saw an enemy airplane. So the arrival of the Mustang at the right time and General Jimmy Doolittle's decision, I think, were two key factors in defeating the Luftwaffe and then allowing the invasion and the general downfall and then the defeat of Germany. Now, having said that, I don't want you to think that the fighter pilots won World War II in Europe. It took everything we had, all the services, the home front, and particularly the home front, production of war materials. We overwhelmed the Germans is what we did. And so it took everybody, not thing, but that was a significant thing in getting air superiority so that you could invade Germany. Okay, one more war story. And this one will, I'll probably need a little help later on, Jack. And this points out something. The Mustang was a great airplane. It just flew great. It was high performance. I just can't say enough about the airplane. And the long range, of course, was its outstanding factor. But it still was very maneuverable and just a great airplane, a perfect airplane for that theater. But the B model... well, both models have the fuselage tank right behind the pilot, 85 gallons. And when that thing was full, the airplane was actually unstable. Now, when unstable, what I mean is, say, like you're pulling a turn, and you pull harder and harder and harder and harder to make it tighter and tighter and tighter, and you get that extra G in there. Well, when you have an unstable airplane... The stick forces start to lighten up. Not yet, Nick. uh, And the stick forces start to lighten up, and pretty soon you're pushing forward. The airplane is trying to pitch up by itself, and you get a stick force reversal from pull, pull, pull to push, 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 push to keep it from turning up and stalling. And kind of unnatural, but I hadn't been to the test pilot school yet, so I didn't know the difference, and I just pushed. And that brings up fuel management. You really wanted to go have all your fuel a long way. By the way, when you burned that fuselage tank down half, it flew like a dream. And so if you wanted to have as much fuel as possible, you know, on a long range, what you did, you took off on a main tank because you wanted to empty that down a little bit. There was a feedback from the carburetor. Any extra fuel you didn't use went back into the left main tank. So you burned that down. Then you burned the... This is the max configuration. You burned out your big wing tanks underneath the wings, 108-gallon pressed paper tanks. And you burned those out. Then you went to your fuselage tank, burned it halfway down, and then you're ready to fight. So now some groups just wouldn't even fill them up. They filled them up half full for takeoff. But if you wanted all that fuel, and I did, I'd always took the fuel. So we have this one mission, and it was a really deep mission. I think it was back into Posen, Poland, or someplace like that. And I wanted all the fuel, took off, we're flying, we're escort. On that day, I was on the close escort with a four ship. And the bombers flew in these huge, long streams, just as long, far as the eye could see, you know, huge formations of maybe kind of a 60 groups and another 60 and a 60 and a 60, just for miles and miles. Just incredible sight, especially when they're pulling contrails. It's one heck of a display of power. And then you put 1,000 fighters along with 1,000 bombers. It's pretty impressive. So we're escorting. I still have a full fuselage tank, and we're going along, and we hear up ahead that they're starting to be attacked. And what one of their tactics was to make head-on passes. The bombers would be in this stream, and they just go through them right head on. It was difficult for them to shoot, but it made them less vulnerable. But they only had a short time to shoot, and if they're close range, they couldn't miss, and then they'd roll over and run. So we're coming up, and we hear this noise, and we had dropped our tanks. We're on the fuselage tank, and we're cruising up to the front of this little section of bombers. And I look up there, and here comes four ME-109s. I'm getting close, Jack. And
how are you going to do four?
Oh, four. I'll show you. Well, there's four, wingtip to wingtip. Here the bombers are, and they got four of these ME-109s, and they're coming in wingtip to wingtip right at the bombers. And we're back here. So we're rushing up the front to intercept them. They go through the bombers, wingtip to wingtip like that, fired, shot down two bombers, and then they made a in-position roll down. It was really fun to watch how they flew. And then came back out, and they were climbing up here to maybe make a second attack. And wow. You know, I cut across there, and as they turned in to come after the bombers, we intercepted them, and that broke them up. Now, where am I? I'm right out in front of the bombers. This huge formation is coming this way, and I'm here with the German, just one versus one, turning, and the bombers are coming, coming, coming. I'll tell you what, that was an exciting moment because pretty soon the B-17 got so big I could see the guns in the cockpit and things like that. Now, the bomber guys in those days, and I don't blame them, if you pointed your nose towards them, they're going to take a shot at you. And so I think they had a policy of shoot anything and sort them out later. They had terrible losses. And this airplane here looks like a Messerschmitt. The P-47 looks something like a Focke-Wulf. The poor P-38s, everybody could recognize them.